And so our goal is to continue to create more access and make it easy for companies of all sizes, from startups to publicly traded companies, to get access to the latest and greatest payment technology.
Hey, welcome to PayPod, where we bring you conversations with the trailblazers shaping the future of payments and fintech. My name is Kevin Rosenquist. Thanks for listening. Richie Cerna is an incredibly driven entrepreneur. He grew up in a rough part of Southern California and, with his parents' help, avoided the pitfalls that so many young people fell into. He went to Harvard, spent time in Los Angeles working on gang prevention and youth development in the mayor's office, and eventually founded Finix, a payment technology company that helps companies become payment facilitators, giving them the tools to build their own payment systems rather than relying on third-party processors. Finix strives to democratize access to payment technology, and they even use some of their funding to help founders of color get their startups off the ground. He has a big heart and a lot of knowledge on the payment space. You'll really enjoy this interview. Please welcome Richie Cerna.
Your career trajectory is fascinating to me. You're a fintech CEO and co-founder now, but you graduated from Harvard, where you focused on government, and started your career in Los Angeles working on gang prevention and youth development.
Oh man, you went deep.
I found that really fascinating. What drew you to want to help young people avoid that path?
Yeah, so I'll go a little bit back into kind of my early origins and where I came from. But my parents immigrated from Mexico back in the 60s and 70s, and they both met in Southern California in a city called Santa Ana. So it's down in Orange County, 80-90% Mexican American population. And I have probably like 30-40 like first cousins down there. My dad was one of 11,
wow.
And close-knit family. And at the same time, it was still a neighborhood that was marked by drug addiction and youth gangs. And so growing up, that was something that was very a real part of my upbringing. In fact, like it was like one of those places where you couldn't wear specific colors. I wasn't allowed to cut my hair short enough. My mom was like very anti-tattoos, couldn't play with toy guns because that was such a prevalent part of my upbringing. Family members were a part of that sort of like lifestyle. And honestly, up until I was like 18, I had this like random fear that I was going to go to prison for something because it was such a common aspect of the day-to-day of that neighborhood. And so once I was lucky enough to go to Harvard, I had a close family member who went to jail for being a part of a gang activity and made me really think about the criminal justice system more broadly. And so when I was younger, I thought about being a lawyer, and mostly because I had read this article that it was like 50% of Fortune 500 CEOs are either lawyers or engineers. And so I thought, hey, why not go into law? And so that's why I studied political science and saw this incredible opportunity to intern at the mayor's office in LA. And LA is one of the only cities in the country that actually has a division that's specifically dedicated to addressing the youth gang problem, but not from a criminalization perspective, but instead from a programming perspective. And so one of the periods during the year that ends up having the highest amount of gang activity is actually the summer, because that's oftentimes in low-income communities when school is out, there's not enough jobs for the youth, there are no summer programs to keep kids busy, and so inevitably when people are out and about, they get into trouble. And so we did this this program called Summer Night Lights, where we actually put on an entire summer's worth of program in the most highly gang active neighborhoods. And we had zero homicides that occurred in those neighborhoods during that period. And they ended up expanding it, and it became a pretty great case study for a number of cities. But yeah, that was something that was always something I focused on. And it was actually at the end of that summer when I realized that there really wasn't enough capital going into addressing this problem. And the whole city of LA, which I think is like 8 million people, had a $1 million budget for this division.
Jesus.
And
it seems low.
I mean, if you think about it, right, you can get like, you know, a deck in San Francisco, a few slides, and raise $1 million, free product, free revenue. And they throw these checks left and right and realize that, you know, especially for the types of problems and issues that were important to me, there needed to be more folks with capital to really address these types of problems. And so ended up making that shift and deciding that I needed to go not necessarily into the legal space, but into, you know, the corporate world in hopes of being able to, you know, sort of have enough influence from a capital perspective to address these types of problems. And so I started off my career then in management consulting. I tried investment banking, didn't love it, went into to management consulting out in New York. And that was my first job out of college. And so kind of had a few different areas of interest from there, but happy to go in deeper in any of those topics that you, you know, think are interesting.
Yeah, I find it very interesting. I mean, like, you know, that's a really, really interesting path. So after the internship and all that, like, what where did you head after that? Because I had an internship at first it was Los Angeles, and then what was the other internship?
First it was the LA mayor's office, and after that it was JP Morgan and their investment group. And then after I graduated, I went to Booz and Company, one of the big consulting firms out in New York. I ended up having this conversation when I was working at the mayor's office with some sort of elder statesmen who were very active in the Latino politics space. They basically said something to the effect of, like, what we need is not necessarily more Latino politicians. We need more Latino billionaires, which I found curious because there aren't very many, if any, that I can really think of off the top of my head. And he basically shared that when he thought about the congressional caucus, there's a lot of demographic specific groups, and the Latino community actually has raised the least amount of capital and even less when you think about the per capita population that we have. And so there's a lot less less capital that goes to a lot of the issues that impact our communities. And that was sort of one of these light bulb moments for me that, sure, you can have impact, you know, and there's a lot of folks who are doing a lot of great work, boots on the ground, but I had a unique opportunity to get into another space. And it's something that's still, you know, whether it's increasing opportunities for founders of color, investors of color, it's still something that I am actively involved with to this day.
So how did you end up becoming a founder, a co-founder?
Ooh, so...
Was entrepreneurship on the docket for you? Like, is that something that you kind of had an interest in early on?
Yeah, I definitely did. When I got to college, we didn't have a business school. So there's Harvard Business School, which is, you know, for the postgraduates, but the undergrad did not have a program for that at economics. And so it's a liberal arts school, so you can pretty much study anything and go off after that. So I did my 2 years of management consulting. And I actually thought about getting into hedge funds and private equity. And had interviewed at a lot of the top firms, kept getting to final round interviews, but ultimately wasn't able to get an offer. And so the late stage, you know, private equity folks were like, maybe you should go to the growth stage, which is usually earlier on in the sort of like capital cycle. And then the growth folks said, maybe you should go to venture capital. And after I started like reading all these articles on TechCrunch and these tech blogs, kind of got hooked with the idea of the startup bug. And so I think one thing that really stuck out was, this is 2012. Facebook had gone public, I think, in like maybe 2011. Pinterest was really starting to grow and become a big thing. And it was hard to not see that this was a very unique time in human history, where a 30-year-old kid with a laptop could build a multi-billion dollar company. Mm-hmm. And the barriers to entry were getting, you know, lowered and lowered every single day. And I kind of thought about like my time in college as well, because I didn't know how to code. And so I, before I go to that, I tried to start a bunch of ideas, and I maybe worked on 3 or 4. And each one, I kept getting stuck at the actual prototyping phase. And inevitably, when you're not technical, you ask every engineer that you know, mm-hmm. hey, help me build this idea. And every single engineer that you know probably gets like 30, 40 people asking them all the time, put half of the company to build this thing for me. And so they, of course, passed on that. And so I spoke to my buddy who was an investor about my ideas. And he said, you know, don't quit your day job. He said, you can't code, your parents aren't rich, and you've never worked at a rocket ship startup. Nobody's going to back you. Mm-hmm. And so I couldn't really change, you know, my upbringing, and I couldn't necessarily find the next rocket ship startup. But I could, you know, think about learning how to code. And so when I thought back on our time in college, of your 4 years, only 2 years of it are really dedicated to your specific degree.
Sure.
The rest of it, usually these other, like, you know, extracurriculars, general
eds.
Yeah. Ed, exactly. And so I was like, all right, well, I was 24 at the time and thought, hey, I have the rest of my career. Why not just spend an extra 2 years and learn how to code? And so I ended up reading this article, funny enough, like a week or two later, about people moving to San Francisco to learn software engineering, people who were quitting their jobs, starting a completely new different career. And so I made the jump in 2013, moved to San Francisco, and that was how I broke into the industry. And so there was a little tiny office in Chinatown in San Francisco. There was maybe like 30, 40 people who were all learning, you know, software engineering, and kind of caught the bug there. And the very first company that I interviewed with, I begged them basically for a job, nonstop, you know, inbound emailed them till they took my interview and said, hey, I will code for food. And I brought some of the investment banking mentality, and I was like, I'll be the first one in, the last one out. And I did just that. And so they gave me a job. I think I got paid like $15 an hour. And so
did that cover food? I can't imagine it did.
I'd saved up a lot of my money.
Okay, good.
Days. In San Francisco, that's not. It's there. But I saved a bunch of my money for this sort of career pivot. After a year, they gave me a full time job, and that's where I learned payments engineering and really building a company and sort of caught the startup bug and have never looked back since then.
Wow. So now you're CEO of Phoenix. Did I say that right? Phoenix?
Yep, that's right.
I want to read part of the mission statement.
Yeah.
Giving money is a fundamental human activity and critical to the health of our global economy. However, innovation from established financial service providers has failed to keep pace with the needs of innovative SaaS platforms and their users. What do you mean by that?
So if you look at, let's just focus on the U.S. If you look at the U.S. today, 91% of all the payment processing volume goes through these five legacy providers that were built in the 80s and the 90s. And so if you take a step back and you think about, hey, well, when was the internet broadly commercialized? It was like 1996. These systems were built before the introduction of the internet. They weren't built for the use cases of today, marketplaces, vertical SaaS companies, crowdfunders, P2P, all these things were built after that. They weren't even built, they're still entirely on-premise. Right. If you think about cloud-based infrastructure, companies like AWS, they came about in 2006. And so you've had a tremendous amount of shift in terms of what consumer experiences look like, what the expectations are, new feature functionalities, alternative payment methods, the speed of money movement. If you look at Visa, MasterCard, Amex, and Discover, they continue to roll out new innovative products, but the market doesn't get access to them because of how slow and antiquated these five players are today. And so the way that we've kind of discussed it internally, it's kind of like if 5G internet existed, but your phone is only capable of 3G. And so in turn, who ends up becoming more innovative? You know, the Ubers, the Airbnbs of the world who can hire armies of engineers to build these payment capabilities. And it's been transformational for them from the perspective of the product experience and for their profitability. And so our goal is to continue to create more access and make it easy for companies of all sizes, from startups to publicly traded companies, to get access to the latest and greatest payment technology. And our belief is that if these platforms and software providers have access to that, they can in turn provide better experiences to their consumer that are better, faster, cheaper. So a very simple example, you probably get paid, you know, direct deposit once every 2 weeks via ACH. ACH is an incredibly antiquated system, and it takes 2 to 3 business days for funds to be disbursed. Visa and MasterCard have released out these products that can actually push funds directly to your debit card 365 within seconds. And so that's actually having a huge transformational impact on the way that sub-merchants, gig economy providers get paid. So today, over 70% of Uber and Lyft drivers get paid out from real-time disbursement. So as soon as they complete their shift, they don't have to wait 2 weeks to get their funds. They can get funds instantly in their bank account and go and use them. And so these are the types of things that bringing more innovative technology to payments can really have a real world impact on.
Why? How did these providers fall so far behind? Like, why has there been no motivation to catch up with technology?
So these providers are not tech companies. They never have been. If you really peel back and you look at these five like top companies, and it goes even beyond them, they're really conglomerates. And so one, and the way that we kind of think about it is like there's kind of three issues. The first of which is that pre-internet-based technology, like they were just built so long ago that they're old and antiquated and never got to take advantage of a lot of like the leading technology and best practices that exist today. Secondly, their strategy for growth has never been about R&D. It's been about M&A, right? So mergers and acquisitions. And so if you peel back Worldpay, First Data, Elavon, TSYS, Chase Payment Tech, these companies that most people probably never heard of, but are multi-billion dollar entities, there are really 15 companies that have been sort of cobbled together. And so from an investment banking perspective, they say, hey, if we take these two companies, 1 + 1 = 3, because they can cut costs and they can realize these sort of cost synergies. But you don't realize technical synergies. Instead, what they end up having is they have two platforms with two different databases, two different backend languages, two different reporting services, two different APIs, two different support engineers, two different sales teams. They basically have two different companies. Mm-hmm. And what you end up having now is a pretty massive technical debt issue where you have to be able to manage and service these both of these platforms. And so now if you want to roll out a new feature, you have to roll it out twice. And so when Visa and MasterCard end up rolling out these new products, it's twice as complicated for them to roll them out. And then what ends up happening is for the end user, right, the merchant who's integrating in these platforms, that 1 + 1 is actually 1 + 1 in terms of is equal to 100 in terms of the complexity. Because now they have feature disparities across both of these platforms. Maybe one platform works in-store for the card-present devices. The other devices work online for e-commerce. Maybe one has Google Pay, the other one doesn't. So it just created this massive mess. And it's really difficult for them to be able to pay down that technical debt issue.
Okay. So it really comes down to cost issue, right? Because they could do it if they wanted to spend the money on it, right?
No, I don't think they can. No. I mean, look at JP Morgan. They said, I think it was like last year, Jamie Dimon said that they are going to spend $6 billion on technical debt. And I promise you that $6 billion is not going to be able to solve the problems they have, right? There have been, for the folks here, this is a payment podcast, so you guys are all familiar with Stripe. But Stripe came about, 2009, really with, very simple developer-friendly APIs. Their APIs are all publicly available. You could see Stripe's APIs and say, hey, I'm going to copy that. And these companies were worth $40 billion plus could say, hey, well, I'm going to start over from scratch and try and produce that on their own. And they have. They've tried investing $50, $100, $150 million into just building a new standalone company or technology platform, and they've all failed. Right? They just don't have the technical chops to be able to achieve that. Yeah. And so it's just technology, R&D, developer-friendly API development. It's just not part of their DNA. And it's actually, if you think about it, there's people talk about the API sort of economy, and there's an API for everything. Most APIs suck. there's a lot of really bad APIs, and a lot of folks, people build internal APIs for their own internal consumption of services, but externalizing those so that other developers can integrate in, that's very hard. And most companies, when they develop APIs, maybe the first 10, 20 people were involved with those API development, that API development phase. Most of the other, 1,000 people who work at a company never got that type of exposure.
Do you see any changes coming? Does AI change motivation for any companies or ability to increase their tech, increase their technology at perhaps, less, with less money, with less resources?
Does it allow the large incumbents?
Yeah, the larger companies that are behind. I mean, are they able, do you think this will push them to do stuff on their own, or do you think they're more likely to go with outside third-party vendors?
I think they're going to continue to do what they know, which is continue to try to buy companies.
I think this is going to change it.
I mean, I've spoken to a number of executives at these companies, and they'll tell you behind closed doors, they don't think that their technical teams are capable of solving these problems, right? So if you think about technical debt, right? It's like taking out a loan, right? You're saying, hey, I'm not going to fix this thing. I'm going to take out a loan or accrue this liability against this technology that I should be solving, but I'll pay it down later. Mm-hmm. We now have 20, 30 years of accrued, accumulated technical debt that is almost insurmountable.
Mm-hmm.
If you have, now imagine you have 15 different technology platforms that are accepting payments. If you say, hey, you know, merchants, I need you to stop using like platforms, you know, 9 through or like 2 through 15 and only migrate over to this new one, all of those companies are going to reevaluate entirely new payment processors because they're just saying, well, you're just forcing me to have to do a new integration. I might as well check out what else is out there.
Yeah, I may as well shop around. Yeah.
Yeah. So
that's a good point.
Kind of a catch 22 for them.
Yeah, that's a real good point. You also talk about, excuse me, you also talk about removing technical compliance, regulatory, and global barriers so businesses have access to payment technology. What are the barriers you're referring to and what businesses are most affected by them? Is it this technology issue or is there more to that?
So when you think about payments in particular, it's a very complicated problem space. It's both very broad and deep in terms of the different domain expertises that you have to have. So when people think about payments, they think about, hey, I'm taking this 16-digit credit card number, I'm sending it to a payment processor, and that's all they see. Hell, even as like consumers, we interact with this product so many times per day, but you never think about the complexity that goes behind the scenes, right?
Yeah, definitely.
That's super easy, right? Everything that happens before the transaction and after the transaction, that's what can be very difficult to be able to do. So if you think about everything that happens before the transaction, that's where the compliance and regulatory burdens come into play. So as every new merchant gets onboarded, say you have a coffee shop and you want to start accepting payments, you'll fill out this application, right? That tells you like, what is the business? What do? What do you sell? And behind the scenes, what that payment company is doing is they're assessing and underwriting your reputational risk, your financial risk, and your compliance risk as well. And so there are certain compliance and regulatory bodies that stipulate that you have to make sure that you're performing certain like duties and obligations. So if you guys remember, you know, 9/11 happened, basically you end up having, you know, the two planes flew into the Twin Towers. They realized that a lot of money was being laundered at that point in time to terrorist organizations. And so this organization, FinCEN and OFAC, ended up being created. So anytime you do business with a merchant and other types of financial products, you have to check this database to make sure that whoever you're doing business with is not on those terrorist watch lists. So those are prohibited parties. You also have to make sure that they're not doing business in prohibited industries, things like cannabis and other sort of illicit businesses. You also have to make sure that they are not financially unstable. So you guys all probably remember Fyre Festival, the music festival that Ja Rule put on a few years ago. They sold $30 million worth of tickets to a concert that never occurred. They went bankrupt. It fell on their payment processor. So there's all of these things that are being taken into account when you submit that information, right? Then you have to store credit cards and you have to do it in a compliant way to make sure that bad actors don't steal that those credit cards and put them out on the dark web. You have to figure out how to pay out all of the money movements. So as you can imagine, now you start to see all of these things have to be done before you can start accepting payments. And this is why companies like Airbnb and Uber had to hire hundreds of engineers to build these internal solutions. So we are lowering the barriers by basically productizing those compliance obligations into our product offering. You just have to pay us, pass us the information, and then we will do all those complex checks and underwriting pieces behind the scenes for our customers. And we can do those in seconds.
Wow. Okay. So yeah, I see what you're saying. So that's, that's pretty good barriers you knocked down there. I like that.
Oh yeah, I mean, sometimes like back in the day, right, if you're a merchant, you submit this application, you would literally have a Mechanical Turk. And so Mechanical Turk is something that looks like it's technology, but it's really a human that's running around in the background doing all this work. So you would submit your merchant application, this person would get all of your data, your bank statements, your driver's license, and then go into 20 different providers and manually key them in. I've seen this happen. And as you can imagine, that's highly error prone and just wildly inefficient.
Totally. I mean, like,
It still happens today. It's wild to kind of see this stuff. But yeah, there's obviously a better way to be able to do that in a more effective, impactful way that actually reduces the risk for this type of business.
Mm-hmm. the fintech space has changed dramatically since you founded Finix, what, almost 9 years ago, I think I saw.
8 years? 8 years? 9 years? I don't know. It's a blur.
It's all a blur. I looked it up. It's almost 9 years.
Oh, good to know.
assuming what I read is true. But it's obviously changed a lot.
I've been in payments for over a decade. So
over a decade, okay.
Yeah,
okay.
You count the last payment startup. Yeah, so it's wild.
Yeah, I mean, with the pandemic and the rise of AI, I mean, how has your focus changed for Finix because of those factors?
It hasn't largely changed when it comes to AI. I think, the pandemic grew a lot of different, types of businesses, particularly on the e-commerce side. I think the biggest changes that you've seen in the last decade are really the sort of distribution models of payments. And so when I say that, it really comes down to who is the merchant, right? The coffee shop, the, local restaurant going to for their payment services. And so if you go back to like the early 60s, like when the payment networks were first formed, you would have to go to your bank and apply for a merchant application, and then you would get an account. Then the processors, which are actually different than the banks, the processors are the ones who provide the technology, started reselling payments directly to merchants. Then in the 80s, you had these things called these ISOs, independent sales organizations, basically like sales teams who would just resell payments in return for a residual. In 2010, that's when I first, around that time is where I got into payments, is when you started to see sort of developer-friendly payments. So that's when Stripe, Braintree, Balance, the company that I worked at, were formed. We're making it easier for developers to integrate into payments. And in the last 5 years, what you've seen, and this is, I think, the biggest shift, is you're seeing vertical SaaS companies like Toast, Mindbody, Club Essential, one of our customers who provides software for, golf courses and country clubs and fitness studios, to embed payments into their software as a part of their overall product. And so basically what they're doing is they're transforming themselves into the Square for a particular industry. And they build all the vertically specific tools and solutions to be able to service that industry. Mm-hmm. And so that, I think, is really the biggest change that we've seen. And our sort of, core thesis here is that in the not too distant future, most merchants and sellers and retailers are going to stop going to the big banks, and they're going to go to their vertical SaaS provider to get all their products and financial services. So payments being one of them. And you've seen that with companies like Toast. Toast started off providing software for restaurants. They layered in payments. They even gave away the software for free, and they only monetized on their payments. And then they started adding in other financial services, lending, started adding in issuing, payroll, and other products to really capture the entire sort of banking stack that a restaurant typically would get.
And they become kind of the industry standard. I mean, exactly. Of at least the smaller ones. I know there's larger companies for big chains and stuff like that. But yeah. Toast is sort of that's what everybody seems to have now.
Yeah. Oh, it's a great product. It's a really,
yeah, obviously. Yeah. Isn't it?
Yeah.
One of the solutions you offer that I find really interesting is the white label solution, where you help them create a completely branded payment processing system.
Yeah,
that feels unique. That you can do a completely branded, where you have no one has any idea they're going to Finix. They think that Kevin's Sports Bar is the only place that they're going to. They have no idea they're going anywhere else. Was that like a super important thing to you guys right off the bat when you were building Finix?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, if you think about that Toast example, right? There's still a payment processor underneath Toast.
Sure. Yeah.
All right. And so we're just making it easier for other folks to basically create, the toasts of their particular industry. Mm-hmm. And so if you read the terms of services of these platforms, you will see that Finix is there, but we're making it so easy for these types of vertical SaaS companies, marketplaces, to be able to embed payments as a part of their product experience. Mm-hmm. So when they're collecting data, they're actually sending it to Finix, and we're underwriting that merchant, provisioning a merchant account, and then allowing them to begin accepting payments. So our original product was always really built on developed to be as white labeled as possible, right? We wanted our customers, their brand, to be front and center, because they're the ones providing, the front end experiences, the customer support. And for us, we're that sort of core infrastructure that sits behind. And we're perfectly happy with that. And it's something that, takes a different type of design and product approach and strategy to be able to make it so seamless for our customers.
Yeah, and I think that it helps with trust, because I feel like a lot of times when you feel like you're being taken somewhere else, even if it's a reputable company, you know, like Finix is, you know, you still are just like, wait, where am I now? Like, am I putting my credit card in the right place? Like, I don't know. There's a trust aspect, I think, that goes along with full on branding.
Oh yeah. I mean, it's funny, because if you go back to some of the earliest versions of software being embedded in payments, you think about PayPal and eBay, right? You had
that's the first time I ever did that kind of stuff. Yeah. Was definitely eBay.
Yeah, you had eBay as the listing website, but you couldn't actually accept payments.
Mm-hmm.
Then you had to go to PayPal, set up an account, and then you kind of bought those things together. Today, now PayPal is such a big entity that it has that innate trust built in, and trust is key to every part of the payments experience.
Sure.
But if new startups start popping up and you never heard of them, that's a trust barrier. And so you know that you're doing business with this particular website, just that frictionless experience is very key for both the consumer and for the merchant.
Yeah. And it makes it easier, makes it quicker, everything like that. Yeah. I think that's a really good, that's a really important thing for me personally. I like the branded options just because it makes me feel better about who I'm giving my information to.
Yeah, absolutely.
There's a lot of payment methods these days, obviously. I just recently started using Google Pay, and I don't know I don't know what took me so long. I really don't. It's awesome. I love it. It's so fast. It's convenient. It's great. How important is it for merchants to be able to accept a variety of payment methods today?
Oh, it's absolutely critical. Meeting the consumers where they're at and providing them with whatever seamless experience that they're looking for is super critical. A lot of folks probably don't realize that, you know, the alternative payment methods come in very different forms and form factors. So there's Google Pay and Apple Pay on the web, which is completely different from Google Pay and Apple Pay on your phone, and then Google Pay and Apple Pay on like the hardware that you actually tap. And so when you're looking for a payment processor, understanding that not everybody has all of those, and you have to look at that type of experience as well. We see a tremendous amount of growth on those types of payment experiences. And I think people are becoming more and more used to using their phone and these other alternative payment methods to store their wallets and their credit card details. It's something that we think is just going to continue to grow as time continues.
Yeah, I was going to ask that. Do you think more, there's just going to be more and more payment methods becoming available in the near future? Or do you think there might be some sort of a correction and some will get left behind and we'll end up with just larger players?
I mean, if you think about Google Pay and Apple Pay, they're still actually just storing your credit card. It's just like where it's being stored. Mm-hmm. Makes it easier for you to accept. So in other countries, you have like, you know, WeChat Pay and other types of alternative payment methods. There's a kind of a distinction between like the Google Pay and Apple Pay and the other ones that actually store value on them. The stored valued ones, those have been a little bit slower to adopt, but I do think that with Cash Pay and Venmo, those things could, you know, in the long term, play a bigger role as well. I mean, when you think about these sort of like P2P apps like PayPal, it took a long time for them to develop enough adoption for them to be so ubiquitous that people wanted to use it as a stored value sort of payment method. And for Venmo, it took a long time as well. And then once it becomes ubiquitous, then merchants are willing to accept it as well. And I think the same thing is sort of happening with Square Cash. Square Cash is not this sort of overnight success. They've been working on this product for years, as long as I can remember. And actually, a number of times it almost got killed as a product. And I think a lot of folks are really happy that they didn't do that because it is now, you know, gaining so much traction out in the market as well.
Mm-hmm. How has your early career in social work influenced the way you develop products, like particularly considering your goal to democratize access to payment tech?
I don't know if it's necessarily my early work in you know, politics and things like that. I think that when it comes to formulating a company and thinking about how you want to build it and who are the people that you want at the table, it's definitely influenced that, right? We have an incredibly diverse company from, you know, the individual contributors and team members to the senior leadership team to even our board. And we think about that not just in terms of, you know, ethnic diversity, but gender diversity in a number of different forms that we consider. I think 60% of our senior leadership team is women. On our product team, I think we have like three or four Latinos who are very technical. And so, yeah, I think it's not necessarily, you do have to be intentional about that team building, you have to also think about every part of your organization as well. And so I think, when we came to Silicon Valley, it is probably the most homogenous industry I've ever been in. It's way more homogenous than investment banking. It's way more homogenous than management consulting. We always kind of wanted to do things differently. And I think that comes from my upbringing and background, and giving folks the opportunity here at Phoenix is something that we take a lot of pride in. And so I think you can see that in even some of the programs that we put in place. So we've actually done this thing called the Cap Table Coalition at Phoenix. And so basically we've dedicated 10% of each of our fundraising rounds to angel investors of color. So Black and Latino investors, to help them build a stronger track record in Silicon Valley investing so they can invest in other companies as well and progress their careers in venture capital and maybe even start their own funds. And so that was really a part of I think, my early upbringing, the folks who helped me break into this industry and wanting to pay that back. And we've now, it's sort of spun off into its own organization, and a number of different startups across Silicon Valley and across the country have now participated in that as well. And so I think that's something that's very unique to us. And I don't think that would have been possible if it wasn't for where I grew up and some of those formative life experiences that I had early on.
That's really cool. That's really cool that you guys are doing that. Are you still involved at all with the gang side of things, the youth development side of things, or do you plan on getting back involved if you're not? Or
Not these days as much. I still have like a few friends who still work in that group. But I think, finding where you can have that impact is most key. Hopefully down the line, that's something I can continue to get involved with. For me, in the area that I, now live in, the impact that I can have is really helping with, founders, of color and similar backgrounds, and kind of, coaching and mentoring and giving them, advice to help them through their, journey as well.
That's probably what they need more than anything, probably some of them.
Yeah.
Well, that's awesome, Richie. I really appreciate you being on here, and kudos to you for all the good work you guys are doing. And I really enjoyed the conversation. Thanks for being part of the show.
Thank you so much. Thank you for having me.